The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. It's Thursday, September 19th, 2019. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. How often does that happen? Once a month. Let's all go to the movies. Let's all go to the movies. Let's all go to the movies and find ourselves at a crossroads. Well, when isn't anything at a crossroads? Everything's at a crossroads. Except maybe the idea of crossroads. First you had pavement, then you had stop signs, then you had traffic lights. What's new with crossroads? Nothing's new. They're good. Where was I? Yes. In the middle, or actually the tail end, approaching the tail end, the penultimate day of Comedy Week. We've done stand-up, improv, podcasting, and now we're on to movie comedy. The silver screen. Well, up until the moment the images are projected on it, and then they take the color of said images. Today on the show, we have a film critic from Vanity Fair, Kay Austin Collins. We have two great screenwriters, Dana Fox and John August, and we're going to all discuss the medium that they are experts in and where we're going. We won't need any roads. And that line is from a comedy movie. You know, they're not making them like that anymore. Maybe they are. It's just that the they has changed. Do you know what I mean? If you don't, listen, because we're going to discuss. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust. Built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we kvel. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. I have in front of me the list of top films by decade. So starting with the 70s, you have number 4, The Sting, 8, Smokey and the Bandit, 9, Animal House, and 10, Blazing Saddles, the top grossing films of the 70s. The top grossing films of the 80s include 6, Ghostbusters, 7, Beverly Hills Cop, 8, Back to the Future. You want to go 12 and 13, Tootsie and Crocodile Dundee, I Won't Stop You. Top films of the 90s, 5, Forrest Gump, 8, Home Alone, 9, Men in Black, 13, Mrs. Doubtfire. And then we get to this millennium. I don't know, Passion of the Christ was number 10 in 2004. But there literally has not been a straight comedy that's not either a comic book movie or an animated movie to hit the top 20 films of either the aughts or whatever we're living in now. Why? Business and box office are a big reason, but I think film comedy might be changing. Doesn't matter what I think. It matters what my august panel thinks. And in this case, I mean this literally because we're joined by the host of the Script Notes podcast, John August, whose screenwriting credits include Aladdin, the latest live action one, bunch of other Tim Burton movies, Big Fish, Charlie's Angels, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, other non-Charlie entities. We're also joined by Kay Austin Collins, who is a film critic for Vanity Fair, and he also hosts a podcast with Dana Stevens on Slate called Flashback. And finally, I'm joined by Dana Fox, who is a screenwriter best known as the writer of The Wedding Date, What Happens in Vegas, and the television comedy series Ben and Kate. Dana Fox had a great life until a couple years ago when Dana Perino was hired by Fox, and now she is all but ungoogleable. Hello, guys. Hello, Dana. Hello, John. Hello, Cam. Thanks for coming on.
A pleasure to be here, Mike.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hi, everyone.
So it is, I will blow the whistle on myself by saying you cannot judge the state of comedy just by the state of the box office. Yet, I think it does tell us something. John, do you agree?
Well, you were defining these movies as being straight comedies, and I just don't know that straight comedy means the same thing it did in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s. You know, you were throwing out all the Marvel movies, but like those are very funny movies, and they're written much more like comedies than sometimes I think we give them credit for.
Absolutely. I think Thor Ragnarok's a comedy. I think the Ant-Man movies are comedies. But I would say, and who cares about quibbling over taxonomy, but if there was a total rewrite of those movies and they said, you know what, the comedy isn't working, let's strip it away, let's make this a straight action movie, they'd still get made. You can't say the same thing about Mrs. Doubtfire, although we've seen the trailers with it as a horror movie.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think the comedy in those movies is an essential part of why the Marvel movies have been so successful, is that, you know, Spider-Man is largely a comedy that, you know, where he does have superpowers. Deadpool is a comedy that has some big stunts in it. So I think they are still making comedies. It's just they're not straight comedies. The whole premise is not a comedic premise. It's just characters in an action movie with a lot of jokes and punchlines and you know, setups that normally comedy writers would be doing.
A lot of the common wisdom of the that I was told whenever I was trying to make original comedies about things I cared about was that they don't travel well overseas. That was sort of a big thing. And I think right around that time was when the international box office started to mean as much as the domestic one. There was a time period where you were based, so, you know, you're sort of judged solely on your U.S. box office. And I remember at the time, one of the many weird movies I've done, What Happens in Vegas, was made $80 million in the U.S. and $220 worldwide. And everyone was like throwing me my own funeral. Like they felt so bad for me for that box office. And that was considered a huge failure. And if that happened now, you know, people would lose their minds and say I was a genius and everything's amazing. So it was right around that time that things pivoted and people started to, I think, actually go after that international box office in the same way that they cared about the U.S. one. And comedy, you know, is so dialogue specific. It's so specific to, you know, sometimes making jokes are just so specific to one culture, you know, and I watch, you watch a German comedy and you're like, whoa, this is what's happening? What are these people doing? You know, or French comedy. And you're like, why is everyone acting so crazy? Who is Jerry Lewis? So I think that was always a common wisdom I was given was like, they don't travel well, you know?
I am always yelling, who is Jerry Lewis, at every French movie, even without Jerry Lewis in it. Yeah, Jacques Tati,
Playtime.
That's exactly
right. You have to yell it out no matter what is happening in the movie because you know that it all stems from Jerry Lewis. Like, every weird thing that is happening is coming from Jerry Lewis. Even Mr. Bean comes from Jerry Lewis in some way, even though he was in London.
Do comedies rely more on the identifiable comedic star who always plays a variation of the self?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting question because I think that honestly is a question of what exact month are you in the studio's crisis of trying to figure existential crisis, honestly. It's like, so one month they'll tell me it has to be the name thing because the name is what sells the thing. And the next month they're like, we want to break all new people that no one's ever heard of. And the next month they say, you know, we can't get the movie made unless it's so-and-so. And I sort of feel like you can't go on that roller coaster ride with them. You have to actually just kind of do what excites you as not only a creator or someone who wants to make content that you're excited about, but rather as a person who watches things and just say to yourself, like, well, what do I want to see? What am I going to do? I think that the problem with those people as of now is that they aren't consistently hitting the way that they were before. It used to be that there were like 10 people who were a sure thing in comedy. And it was like, if you could get one of those, you've got your movie made, no questions asked. Number one, those people haven't consistently hit over and over again. And number two, their fees drive the budgets up so high that that sort of prices them out of what people are willing to spend making those movies nowadays. You know, back when I made Couples Retreat, it was like, you know, I think that the budget of that movie was like $73 million. And like, if you told someone now that you wanted to make a comedy with a budget of $73 million, they would just be like, you've lost your mind. And they would tell you to do what John is actually sort of saying, which is then make it an action movie, make it a Marvel movie, make it a movie that can sustain that budget and turn it into an event at theaters. The common wisdom changes all the time. Everything changes, is changing all the time. And I think it's hugely being changed by television right now, because streaming services have created this new sense of like, well, you don't actually have to leave your house to see these movies. And so I think that, you know, that obsession with having your movie come out in theaters is, people just have to let go of it, because I don't know that it is a thing in the same way that it was a thing before for comedy. I think people are, we're training a whole new generation of people to expect to be sitting on their couch and to have not paid much money, you know, to have paid a monthly fee a million years ago on their credit card that they forgot about. So they think what they're watching is free. And that's their expectation, is that they're going to get it for free.
Well, maybe, so does this mean, Cam, that you're the only person in America who for whom there is a distinction between that which is on Netflix and that which is in the theater, because Vanity Fair assigns you to the things in the theater?
I mean, not really, partially because of people like Adam Sandler on Netflix, who has this, I mean, it's like a 6-movie deal, right? That he's almost all the way through, that are by all accounts popular to the extent that we, you know, to the extent that anyone really knows that Netflix's numbers.
I mean, to the extent that you believe their numbers, what was the one he did with Jennifer Aniston?
Murder Mystery.
Yeah. Was seen by 70 million people.
Yeah.
Making it a $500 million. So that would be on my list if you extrapolate average ticket cost for that. I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can do that because there's lower barrier to entry.
Who knows?
But that's something.
That is something. I mean, I think all those Adam Sandler movies being on Netflix is a big thing. As I recall, when he made that deal, all of his past movies also suddenly reappeared, including things that people didn't really go see, like The Cobbler, to the extent that like people have still seen that. Like it's available in a way that, yeah, I do think that going to the movies for comedy in particular feels a little bit antiquated, unless you're doing something like a Marvel movie. I mean, part of the reason that I really love people like Peyton Reed working with Marvel is because he has like intricate CGI-heavy visual comedy that I don't know if it wasn't Ant-Man, I don't know that people would fund that, you know, in the same way. So I value that, but I think also people went to see Blockers. For example, that did fairly well, but things like Booksmart didn't do as well.
Yeah.
So it's really hard. I mean, I think there's still a lot to be said for the movie star driven comedy. There's such a thing as like a Melissa McCarthy movie. I'm always going to see a Melissa McCarthy movie.
She's one of those stars that she's talking one of the, about.
She's like
those
a fairly dependable star, but not in the way that I think people really, really mean when they say movie star, because I just think that people, like box office star, because I think that people have sort of shifted in some ways.
The only movie I saw in theaters twice last year was Crazy Rich Asians. And I wanted to see it in the theater a second time because it was just, you know, visually glorious. It was really funny and it was great to see it with an audience, but it was also, it was a big, expensive looking movie in a world I'd never seen before. And I just loved it sort of being in that place. And so I think there will always be room for these 2-hour blocks of entertainment that are great to see on a big screen with an audience where you can all laugh together. But that doesn't have to be every movie. And so some movies that where you sort of like lower the sort of barrier to entry, where people can just watch it at home and watch it that first weekend at home, that's right. There's a comedy I'm talking about doing right now that I would do for Netflix. And part of the reason why we would want to do it for Netflix is that it's kind of a hard ask to get people into the theater on a Friday night to see this specific movie. But I feel like at home, they would totally be game for it. There's just, it's less of a risk because you're not having to go to the theater, get a babysitter and do all that other work. That's the barrier you're up against whenever you're talking about a big screen comedy versus a small screen comedy.
And I think the thing John is talking about with that communal experience, you know, it is, I sort of mourn the loss of it. You know, this weekend we all went out to see the amazing movie Hustlers by the best human that lives on earth, Lorraine Scafaria. And there was this huge group of us there, but also it was just so amazing being in a room with a bunch of strangers who are clapping, who are laughing, who you feel their energy. And I actually think, I know this is going to sound insane, but I actually think, because I spend summers living in Virginia with like normal human beings who aren't in the film business, in like normal communities where people do have to get babysitters and do have to do all that stuff. But I actually think that the addition of a lot of these like experience theaters where people can go out and like have a bite to eat and drink while they're watching things does sort of help comedy. Hopefully people still actually want to leave their houses to have those experiences and connect and like put their phones away for 5 seconds.
I think Hustlers though is a great example, because do you call that a comedy or not a comedy? Because it's a Scorsese movie, but that's really funny. And like, there's sequences like Loreen knows exactly what she's doing, and there are really hilarious sequences. They're trying to figure out how to cook the drugs in their kitchen. It's really funny in ways that, you know, I don't think you would have made that same movie the same way 10 years ago. I think we're just sophisticated in a way that we are able to take our drama and our comedy at the same time. Succession on TV is another great example of that. Like, that's not really a comedy, but it's written, you know, with jokes and punchlines that are fantastic, as good as any comedy 10 years ago would have delivered. So we're at this weird place where it can be two things at once, and we're comfortable embracing that.
The other thing that I keep asking friends of mine who are like on the executive side, because I've always believed that you should not try to, and I think John and Craig talk beautifully about this on their podcast, like never try to give the business what you think the business wants. Like write something that you actually care about that means something to you for a specific reason. Don't like chase some weird trend that you think is a thing. One of the things that one of my very high-level executive friends said to me was, we are interested in things that are a perspective that is something you haven't really seen before. Hmm. And so I think that's why movies like Crazy Rich Asians kind of blew the doors off that and said, not only, you know, can you show that perspective, but that you don't have to worry about whether it's universal or not. You can actually just go after the audience and, like, fingers crossed, it gets universal and people watch it the way that that became a thing. But I know that studios are actually interested in, like, real point of view stuff. Like, that's why Get Out was so exciting when you watched it, because you were like, I've never seen that. That's crazy. I've never seen that before. It's funny. It's scary. It's a social commentary. It's all these other things. So I think, honestly, it's like the fresh point of view, the fresh perspective on the world. Yes, it's hard to do because the minute you do it, the studio is like, okay, we wanted to buy that, but now we want to make it like other successful things we feel like we've seen before so that we can feel safe. But if you can push it through, you know, I think that is one of the things that people are actually interested in buying right now.
Thank you for saying that Get Out is funny, because every time I try to say that to people, they get weird.
Oh,
I'm like, I'm black. I thought it was freaking hilarious. It's hilarious. It's a hilarious movie. It's a hilarious movie. I mean, it was weird. It was, but you know, to some of these points, when at the Golden Globes that was up for comedy, people got weird about that. As I recall, even Jordan Peele sort of, I think he was joking, but did tweet about, you know, it's not a comedy, but it is. It is.
And horror movies. So it's so interesting. So what I'm getting here, and I want to ask about the implications of this, is that comedy in films, despite my list, did not disappear. In fact, it had the most adaptive behavior. It embedded itself in all these other genres. That is the way to survive. Is anything lost at any cost, do you think?
First of all, I just want to take a pause and say how smart that was, though. I love that comment. I've never thought of it like that, that it's like comedy is like this weird animal that fell to the bottom of a cave that's super deep on one of those like Blue Planet shows. And it's like, I got to figure this shit out. I can't see anything. I got to figure out how not to die. I've never thought of it that way. I love that. But it's like an adaptive, organic, living thing that sort of had to figure out how to survive. But go ahead, John. I'll just say the smarter thing.
I agree. I think how Mike phrased it is really smart. Here's what happened. I think whenever we're talking with people, whenever we're communicating with people, one of the ways we sort of get our point across is just to put some comedy in there, to make it clear like that we're having a connection, we're having a moment here. And that's what comedy is. So whenever two characters are talking, it's likely there's going to be some comedy in there. And so we're going to find ways to thread that through our dramas, through everything we're doing, so that, you know, that the point gets across. So yes, we still make some really serious movies that have no jokes in them at all and no sort of funny moments, but that's sort of not life. I mean, life has funny stuff that happens even in these darkest times. I mean, we are, you know, 3 years now, we've been living in sort of the darkest period of my life in terms of our national politics. But comedy didn't die. And I think we were all really worried that like it wasn't going to be okay to be funny at all anymore, and that didn't come to pass. Like, we recognize that we, you know, have to find what's funny in the situations at all times.
I just wanted to follow up on one strain of the conversation, which is we were talking about how so many of the films that would be released in theaters a decade ago are now on Netflix. Is there no difference, not just in the communal nature, but I think I've heard you and Craig, your co-host on Script Notes, John, talking about this, that there are differences. There have to be editing beats and reaction shots where it does change a bit just by the very dint of it being at home and on Netflix.
Absolutely. So, I mean, things play differently on a big screen than on a small screen. How you're looking, how you're responding to things, whether there is an audience there laughing with you or you're watching at home, you are always mindful of that. And so, as you know, Dan and I are sitting in the editing room with the directors and with editors, like trying to see, like, oh, is this moment funny? We can think we have a good idea, but the reason why we do those test screenings is to see, like, oh, that didn't play at all. That joke didn't work at all. You do. There is. You know, you're fundamentally writing for an audience. And so you might go into it with intentions. This is what you're trying to do. This is why this moment is funny. But ultimately, the audience is going to tell you whether that moment is funny or not. And that's a different thing than, is this moment dramatic or not dramatic? There's no, you know, you don't get to hear the crying. You don't get to hear the, like, oh, that was really touching. You can only hear the laughter. And so if you're not hearing laughter where you're expecting laughter, then you've got to figure out what's going on. It could be the line you wrote, but it could be the reaction shot. It could just be the timing, the pacing. It could be the joke 3 ago that was too similar that just is not working. So that's the craft part of comedy writing, which is different than, I think, a lot of other writing that we do.
It's very hard to create a comedy in a vacuum without a test audience. I mean, like, that's something that has been difficult for me. I'm making a new TV show for Apple, and they're very secretive and they're trying to keep everything under wraps. And so there are no screenings, and I'm at the point in the process where by now I would have had 4 weird test screenings in like Burbank, AMC, whatever. And I'd know all the answers and I would be making all the changes and know all the answers, but I don't have that. So I've felt a little bit like, fuck, okay, here we go. I got to like figure out where I actually think the laugh is and where the exact rhythm of this thing is and use all of my weird institutional knowledge I have from every weird test screening I've ever been to try to like imagine what is working and what's not working. And it's been really weird for me, honestly. I don't really understand how you do comedy without checking it through with, as John is saying, your test audience and kind of figuring out when it's working and when it's not working. Things I've learned through test audiences. Apparently a lot of men, maybe straight men, I don't know, can't laugh if there's also nudity. Like their brains literally, like if they see boobs, their ability to laugh just like they can't stop because their brains just go boobs. And like, so they can't go to, and it's like serious boobs. So they can't laugh when they see boobs. That's sort of an interesting thing to me. And also America, I guess, because I didn't do a test screening in Europe, but America is not a fan of characters who cheat. And if you expect the audience to forgive that cheating character at the end of the movie, you got to take the cheating out of the beginning of the movie. And it doesn't even matter what gender it is. It doesn't matter. Like, obviously, no, you can't have the woman cheat and be expected to be not burned at the stake by the end of the movie. But in the movie I did, there was a man who cheated at the beginning. And like the audience, like no matter what happened, could not forgive his character and root for the relationship to get back together afterwards. Thought that was kind of interesting.
Okay, now here's a supposition, and it's just that, but tell me if there's accuracy to it. I have sensed, not even during my lifetime, but even before, that one major source of comedy in the movies, dialogue-based funny lines, maybe funny rat-a-tat lines from screwball comedies and Bringing Up Baby and those kind of movies in the 50s. We very much moved away from that towards the big, huge comic set pieces. But again, I could be reading this wrong. John, you read a lot of scripts and write a lot of scripts, and so do you, Dana.
Yeah, I think there's something to what you're saying. And I mean, again, I'm so glad we were able to bring it back to Jerry Lewis because I was really hoping we could. But I think there's something to that, which is I was always told when I was working on my comedies that, you know, you have to have these big physical set pieces because that does play overseas. That is funny to everyone everywhere because it doesn't require an understanding of specific language. You know, if you think about like the way that Judd Apatow movie uses language, it's so specific that if you tried to translate it into a foreign language, it might not play. But somebody, you know, smashing someone in the face with a pie is like definitely funny wherever you are. So, John, what do you think about that?
We definitely sort of went through that period where we had all those really high concept comedies, sort of the Jim Carrey, like Liar Liar comedies, the things where like there was a big physical conceit where like there were big opportunities for physical comedy. our comedies we make now, we still have some of those beats. We still have some sort of bigger moments, but I think we are kind of getting back to a little bit more of that rat-a-tat-tat. So either the dialogue is naturalistic or it's very joke dense and everything's a little bit optimized. I mean, a Seth Rogen comedy will be that same kind of optimization of things. And so, you know, it does swing back and forth. It's just whatever's realistic inside the world of the movie you've created. And you basically have, you know, 2 minutes at the start of your movie to sort of set the rules for, like, okay, characters in this movie are going to talk a certain way, and these are the kinds of things. This is how much we're bending the rules of gravity and physics in this movie. And once you establish that, your audience will go with you. It's only if you sort of break that promise that you're going to have a problem.
So, John, are these the sort of issues, just the stuff that a podcaster outside of the industry thinks of when you sit down with your fellow professionals? Are you talking about things like that?
What we talk about a lot over lunches is, like, what is a movie anymore? Because it used to be really clear, like, a movie was a thing you saw on a big screen, and it was about 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And now it's just not so clear what it is. And so... Yeah. We
45 TikToks together.
That's what it is. Stream them all together as a piece. So I think Dana and I are mostly writing things that are around 2 hours long. They follow one character's journey, you know, through the course of a story. And we're calling that a movie. But if you look at, like, a season of Fleabag, it's almost the same thing. And so
right.
And if you look at
Infinity War plus whatever the other ones in that, you know, just portion of the triad were called, it's also not that.
No, right. I mean, you can look at the Marvel Universe as being just like a giant TV series where every episode cost $300 million and took a year to make. And so we're at this really weird transition point. And so it can be sort of an esoteric conversation, like, oh, what is a comedy? But it weirdly for me and for Dana and for other screenwriters, it's a sort of fundamental existential question, because we are paid to write specific things. And if we are writing something if I'm writing a movie for Disney, like Aladdin, I get paid a certain way, and there's a certain expectation of how that all is going to work. But if I write this exact same movie for Disney Plus, I'm paid very differently, and the structures behind that are all different. And so that's a weird thing that we're going to be heading into in the next 5-10 years, is figuring out what even is a movie or a TV show. Kind of, what are we writing for? What is this screen? And what is the expectation of how someone is going to watch this thing?
So let's say it is changing, but how, and this is exactly what I want to get at with this conversation about comedic movies.
I guess it's sort of like the boundary between, like, what is our expectation as an audience for how much entertainment we're supposed to be sitting down to get, you know, What is the beginning and end of this story? You know, are we expecting a prequel or a sequel to this thing that was before? If we're remaking all these Disney movies, how faithful do we have to be to the original thing? You know, that sense of, you know, where are the outside edges of this piece of entertainment are just very different.
I think the only thing I know the stable definition of right now is sitcom. Mm-hmm. I know what a sitcom is.
Right.
I can't tell you what a movie is changing and TV is changing, and so many short films.
Oh, yeah.
Could
how many
be
cameras
pilots.
Does a sitcom have?
Depends.
Yeah.
So, but even still, I know what a sitcom is. And I feel like that still has a lot of kind of tactile value, because when you hear about Netflix acquiring these older TV shows for tons of money, it's sitcoms.
Right.
These things I understand. But then beyond that, I mean, what is a movie? I don't know. It's changing a lot. I mean, Steven Soderbergh makes movies on iPhones now. So everything's changing. And I think that's a good thing. But it does make a lot of these other conversations really slippery. Even things like rom-com,
et cetera. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that the weirdly freeing thing for me about it has been that I have stopped chasing it. So I'm now doing things that actually, like, feel good to me. Like, so I say to myself, like, I have to care. I have to feel something. I have to care. I have to want this so badly, because A, it's going to be so fucking hard. It'll be unbelievable. And, you know, B, no one may ever see it. And instead of being paralyzed with fear about that, I've chosen to feel really freed up by it.
The movies that you cited at the start, which were big hits, well, those were big hits to a very mass audience. And the expectation is, like, a comedy had to play to a really broad audience. These comedies we're talking about don't have to play to a really broad audience. So, you know, a great show like Pen 15, it can be so specific and so niche, and you like only certain people are going to find it funny or get it, but those people are going to find it hilariously funny. And that is a good thing about where we're at right now, is that you can make something that's like genius and brilliant like that and not have the expectation that it has to make $100 million at the box office. It can be its own unique thing. So that is the good thing about where we're at right now in 2019.
John August is the screenwriter behind many a Tim Burton movie, several other credits. Listen to his Script Notes podcast. It is the gold standard. I feel like that's almost a clamor, a cliche. Dana Fox is a screenwriter behind Couples Retreat, What Happens in Vegas, and apparently some new iPhone 11 Pro Max type content. And Kay Austin Collins is the film critic for Vanity Fair. His podcast is on Slate. It's called Flashback. He co-hosts with Dana Stevens. Guys, thank you all so very much.
A pleasure.
So great to be here. Thanks, guys. Great.
Thanks.
And that's it for today's show. Daniel Schrader produced The Gist. He has long argued that In the Name of the Father was a comedy. Then he realized someone had switched the VHS label with Daddy Daycare. The Gist. If it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny. But if it breaks and the shards go flying and they stab a mounted policeman's horse and the horse takes down the street, cut to a mugging in a nearby alley, cut to the police horse stopping short, throwing the policeman rider, mugger, dialogue to victim, the police aren't going to fly in and save the day. Boom! At that moment, the flying policeman crashes into the mugger, who is disarmed. No, you're right. It's still not funny. Oompa-roo-de-pa-roo-doo-pa-roo, and thanks for listening.